and welcome to Worlds Apart. When a former EU official called the European Union a garden and the rest of the world a jungle waiting to invade, he was quickly accused of racism and colonial biases, but not of delusion or misperception, even though Josep Borrell clearly stated that the Europeans have built the best social system humanity has ever known. Mr. Borrell may be gone, but this view of Europe as the paradise on earth still lives on. How does it shape the EU foreign policy vis-a-vis the proverbial jungle? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by John Pang, former Malaysian government official and founder of the ASEAN Research Institute. Mr. Pang, it's amazing, truly amazing to talk to you. Thank you very much for this time.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Now, historically, Europe was the birthplace of many impactful ideas and ideologies, some of them very life-affirming, some of them very damaging and destructive. Do you think this current official view of Europe as the pinnacle of social evolution, as the place that everybody wants either to inhabit or copycat from, do you think it's affirmed by reality?
Well, it's certainly not affirmed by reality anymore. And that's obvious, actually, to everyone, and perhaps even to most people in Europe. But I think it stands as ideology. It's very sticky. It's very hard to get rid of. And you hear it emerge again when people like Josep Borrell speak, because it has a key ideological function. I think it's foundational to the self-conception of European elites, and it plays a very important role in their political consciousness.
I heard you say before that when you used to work for ASEAN institutions, and for our viewers from other parts of the world, ASEAN stands for the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. It's a group of 10 countries who are committed to economic and security cooperation, but without sacrificing their sovereignty. That's a very important point. So I heard you say that when you used to work for ASEAN institutions, you would have European officials come and tell ASEAN countries that essentially if you behave good, if you, you know, comply with all our prescriptions, one day you will grow up and be like us. I wonder how it was perceived back then.
Yeah, thank you for reminding me of what I said there. Yeah, I think that's that statement and that sentiment that ASEAN was just something on the way, right, to an incomplete, a baby European Union. And if we, you know, ate our cereals and were good, and one day we would grow up and become like the European Union. So I think this is the sense that Europe is at the end of history. It's at the terminal point, is where not just where everyone wants to go, but where you are inevitably going to go if you want progress, right? Yeah. If modernity has its way, if you modernize your societies and you do everything right, that's where you're going. Mm-hmm. And the form of that collectively is European Union.
That's essentially, a form of religion reaching its end point. And I wonder if you think that belief was genuine, or was it more of a sort of persuasion tool of, uplifting yourself by, pressing everybody else down?
Well, it certainly plays that psychological role. But it's more interesting to go beyond the psychological role to look at the ideology and the beliefs. Now, one thing Europe does very well, and one thing the West does very well, is to take its very particular and actually provincial beliefs and systems and social model and universalize them for the rest of the world. This was a key sort of technique of European colonialism. Mm-hmm. And it's, as I keep saying, it's central to their ideology. It's what justifies, in their view, their dominance. Mm-hmm. So it has that kind of a role, and that's why it's particularly, sticky. You wouldn't expect that so many years after, the last of them relinquished their colonial holdings. Actually, France, for example, still has, colonial outposts, but it's still very much there in the political culture.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And in his famous remarks about the garden and the jungle, Mr. Borrell also mentioned some of the sort of material aspects of this belief. He mentioned a combination of political freedom, economic prosperity, and social cohesion that, in his view, allowed the EU garden to bloom so supremely. But I think back in 2022, when he made those remarks before that, and certainly now, the EU has it has been plagued by numerous economic, social, and political problems, which were for everybody to see, but somehow the leadership managed to ignore them. How long do you think the EU can afford to overlook all of that for the sake of maintaining this glorious self-perception?
A short answer is not very long, in my view. It really does seem to be coming apart, and it's a wonder that they can hang on. Every European leader is, you know, about the most unpopular leader, democratic leader in the world. It seems almost to be a qualification for government that you have something like, you know, a maximum of 25% of the popular vote, and have a large proportion of the population actually disfavoring you. So I don't see this as a sustainable situation. You know, what we hear a lot in the media is a view that even in Europe, I think is very much in contention, that's discredited and rejected. So there's a big gap. You know, many of the things I say would seem actually like common sense to a lot of Europeans, namely things like, you know, each society, different civilizations have different ways of organizing yourself, and there are different ways to organize, you know, your one's common good and common prosperity. And the current European model of 2025 isn't the only way. It wasn't even the only way for European countries before 2025, let us say 50 or 100 years ago.
Absolutely. And it wasn't always like that. I mean, even, you know, let's say 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, you know, the European Union was perceived, and I think it genuinely aspired to be, you know, an entity that truly stood for multilateralism, for regionalism. There were a whole series of very thoughtful, well-educated, and I think quite open-minded, cosmopolitan, and respectful to differences kind of leaders. But you yourself once asked, how did we go from Adenauer to Ursula von der Leyen? And I wonder what's your own answer to that question?
Yeah, this is the huge puzzle, because, you know, you describe it so well, the things that we admired them for, and I was among them. It turns out, in retrospect, quite naively, looked up to those institutions and thought that they were more independent, had more integrity and sovereignty than it turns out they do have. Because under the pressure of history, you know, one by one, they've collapsed, and collapsed with profound, you know, finality, is a truly emphatic sort of collapse. You know, their attitudes towards the war in Ukraine, and their attitudes towards the tragedy in Gaza, the massacre in Gaza, are astounding. I can't emphasize how discrediting that is. This is moral and cultural disqualification from the perspective of much of the world that is, you know, truly breathtaking, that you really don't recover from. So, you know, how did we get from here to there? This is a difficult question. I have my own thoughts about it, right, to do with you know, liberal ideology, for example. I think, you know, when you talk about this being a religion now and Europe behaving as if it was under the grip of that, I think that's a part of the answer as well. Because they're not even rational in their own terms. They're not doing the best for themselves, right? They're willing to harm themselves, to harm Russia, for example.
I think possession would be a more accurate term than religion, because in possession, people are gripped by certain ideas, but they are absolutely blindsided to how it is reflected in reality. Now, you mentioned the war, the word war, and I do want to ask about that, because you wrote before that war is structural to Europe, and even European thinkers are pretty clear that, you know, they see the European project as a solution against endless wars. But we also know from psychology and from the history of, you know, ideas, that when you try to defend yourself against something, when you're running away from something, you're very likely to materialize that very thing in reality, because that's essentially how human psyche works. I wonder if the current EU composition, or the current EU aim as a solution against endless wars, makes conflict far more likely.
That's a very interesting, hypothesis you have there. This is the dark side of Europe. But when I wrote that war is structural to Europe, I was talking about the way in which Europe, right, is truly extraordinary in historical geography, shall we say, for the amount of violence, interstate violence that it had, other parts of the world, such as, East Asia, the contrast is between night and day. There's just no comparison. It's not that people didn't go to war with one another, but the regularity of it, like, for example, between China and Japan, over, I don't know, something like an 800-year period, you had one conflict before the modern era. Or two, something like that. And in Europe, you can barely count this. So there is something about this, about Europe and its relationship to war. Now, here's the really interesting thing. The European Union, one looked up to that, if nothing else, because it was supposed to be the solution to Europe's perpetual wars. And it turns out, after that, in the conflict in Yugoslavia, the attack on Serbia, for example, and afterwards on Libya, and then the onward eastward expansion of NATO, it becomes the primary cause of war in Europe. It's absolutely structural. NATO expansion will cause war. And then when they started, it became very real for us when they talked about having NATO in Asia. I think I did write, Asia needs Europe like we need a hole in the head. We absolutely do not need the logic of European state thinking, European notions of interstate, the logic of interstate relations, mm-hmm. which at the moment, is animated by violence. Mm-hmm.
But absolutely, it's a very interesting point that you're onto, because when you try to put an end to war now and for all, what you're essentially doing is that you're dissociating the various ways of dealing with aggression. What you need is not pushing them out, but to find conscious ways of dealing with interstate violence. Yep. And before that, you also need to find conscious ways of dealing with interstate disagreements. But if you just mandate the war out, that's likely to bring it back.
Here's the truly infantile, and I have to say that this is infantile psychologically and perhaps even developmentally in the individuals involved. This, the current European notion of security is infantile in the sense that you want to have the absence of war. You want to assure security for yourself, an absolute security, with zero notion of the security of the other. Against this, other nations, not least Russia, right? China, of course, included. Malaysia, you name them, have notions in which security is there's a common security. I am not secure unless my neighbor is also secure, finally. That we are next to each other, for example, Ukraine, Russia, Ukraine, and the rest of Europe. And you do not have security by trying to annihilate the other, because that notion of security, the flip side of it, is it's exterminationist. The logic of that is exterminationist.
Absolutely, I think we both know that the European continent has plenty of experience in that realm as well. But Mr. Pang, for the time being, let's take a very short break, but we will be back to this conversation in a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with John Pang, a former Malaysian government official and founder of the ASEAN Research Institute. Mr. Pang, before the break, we started talking about this growing divide between the United States and Europe. The Americans, it seems, are walking away from this end of history hypothesis because they do recognize it as not only self-delusional, but also self-harmful. I mean, that's the main message that the Trump administration projects, that it's not only very expensive, it brings no value and it increases all the risks. And yet the Europeans are persisting down that track. And I think that's very evident in the crisis in Ukraine, where they, whatever they say, they still seem to be very committed to continuing that war. How much do you think this need for maintaining this image of themselves as the paradise on earth, how much of a role do you think it played in the Ukrainian crisis? Did it contribute to it?
The Ukrainian crisis, in an interesting way, brought up in a highly regressive way, actually, this notion of European solidarity. Remember that early moment when they, you know, it was as if they rediscovered the West. Once again, people were talking about the West without any irony, you know, against the rest, against the jungle, and so on. And, you know, to that extent, I think that, you know, Europe and its divergence with the U.S. now is very, very interesting because you have a departure in the U.S., a, shall we call it, populist departure from that end of history liberalism, which is also happening in Europe and which they are trying to quash. So now Europe is isolated in a way that terrifies them. And their reaction actually is depressing. Actually, their reaction is to double down on it rather than questioning their isolation. So it's perhaps even more dangerous because now they're even more deluded, even more unhinged, they're detached from reality. And I have to say this, you know, German and official German and a British and even French attitudes towards, you know, the conflict in Ukraine are just completely, I mean, from our point of view, completely detached from reality.
But on the other hand, this is exactly how little kids behave. When you take away their toy, they start, you know, stamping their feet and pouting their lips and insisting on getting what they want. And to some extent, I mean, I've heard some analysts suggest that what the European leadership is doing right now is trying to imitate that they have some influence rather than trying to exert that influence because, you know, all they do is sabotaging. They're sabotaging the peace process. But ultimately, it's a very convenient strategy because, you know, it gives you a lot of public, you know, a lot of publicity, a lot of noise. It gives you some narcissistic gratification that you are important. But on the other hand, you don't have to do anything. I mean, you don't have to do anything apart from the lip service. You don't have to send your soldiers to Ukraine. You don't have to devise a strategy. You don't have to, you know, implement policy. All you can do is to write these amazing, glorious speeches and deliver them with a gusto from a pulpit.
Exactly. I mean, that goes partially towards explaining the really puzzling detachment. You're saying that this might be a way to just avoid the issues. But I think this is compounded by the fact, and I want to return to this, that they seem to systematically elect individuals who in any other context, right, to put it really kindly, are not suited for the role, are not up to the role. So this is my question. How do you get from Adenauer to, you know, Kaya Kallas or, you know, von der Leyen? This needs explaining. And it's not a, you know, it's a process on which one can't be too polite about it. How did you get to a group that systematically elects people like that who endanger everyone by their inability to do diplomacy?
I think you partially at least answered that question in your writing because I heard you make a very interesting point in another interview that the Europeans are deadlocked not only geopolitically but ideologically because liberalism no longer seems to suffice as an organizing, as a society organizing idea. And while the rest of the world seeks inspiration for nation building in cultural or religious traditions, the Europeans cannot avail of that because they had to put all that heritage on the altar of European integration. It is as if they're sort of, you know, worshipping the god of liberalism for the sake of keeping the EU project alive. Do you think that's reversible? Can Europe still redefine itself in ways old or new?
To be honest, it's hard to see reversal and reform without some kind of serious disruption and collapse. Mm-hmm. It's probably not politically correct for me to say this. You know, the easy thing would be to say one could do incremental reform, but you really, you know, cut deep to the question there. I think it's deeply a cultural, ideological problem that is not just the last 50, 70 years. It didn't begin with the European Union. There's a certain course of history that's coming to an end, or a course of anti-history, of Europe rejecting the very basis that I spoke about in favor of a sort of god of progress, of endless self and sort of destruction, a progress that is defined as destruction of tradition, right? Of social ties, of traditional ties, of unchosen, relationships, of kinship, of natural relations. So it comes out in all kinds of ways that people find, the rest of the world find bizarre, but they are related from that perspective. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's really hard to see this come apart, but the elite, you know, it seems to me are extremely tied to this. But I wouldn't, you know, but from the ground, one sees all sorts of interesting things, and it's a place with deep culture. Hopefully at some point they retrieve that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think you partially covered that already, but I still want to pose that as a separate question. Why do you think liberalism in and of itself is not enough as a guiding or uniting principle, not only for Europe, but let's say for a large society?
I don't think it has enough of an account of the human and of the social. I think it has a deeply inadequate, a very, very thin, and it turns out, inadequate account of what it means to be human in its radical individualism. We are simply seeing in Europe the working out of the radicalism at the base of liberalism. Because the ideology, in the sense of this, is there are only individuals. There is not, as Margaret Thatcher reminded us, there is no such thing as society. It's just an aggregation, an economic arrangement or a market of individuals or a state. But other forms of human collectivity, the family, the nation, these are just sort of, to liberalism, these are things to be overcome. And to people in the rest of the world, these are things to grow into. This is how you transcend yourself and build something, right? These are not just the limits of the human. This is the frame in which you become human. So the liberal thing is, in that perspective, deeply, and I must say, it's a kind of metaphysical desert. You just don't have, there's not enough water there, right, to live on.
And yet, Mr. Peng, this ideology seems to be very attractive to developing countries, or perhaps what attracts is the good living conditions that come with it. Now, we mentioned Ukraine a couple of times. It is definitely not the first country to be seduced, not even by the promises, but some faint intimations that one day it too may join this magnificent garden. But Ukraine certainly is the country that lost the most in going down the route of this intention. Do you think there will be other nations willing to partake in the EU glory?
I think Ukraine is a strange combination which reveals a deep contradiction in modern European liberalism, and that is its alliance with ultra-right elements. Because it wasn't just liberals that took over, you know, they were part of that, of the coup. There were also extreme right elements left over from the 1930s and the 40s, right? Basically an unreconstructed Nazi ideology, I have to say. And how is that so well aligned with liberalism? So, but in a way, both have a common origin, a common parentage in this rejection and in the case of the right wing, of the extreme right, a kind of reconstruction of identity on very thin principles. So it isn't just, you know, Ukraine is a very interesting example of an alliance of really far-right elements with these, you know, so-called globalist, very, very cosmopolitan liberals. In fact, they reject. You might say the extreme right in Ukraine would reject these liberal values. But they are an alliance, and I think there's a real affinity between them. Now, as for the rest of the world, I think the attractions of liberalism, including liberal popular culture, etc., it's over. Mm-hmm. If you look at pop culture in Europe, you look at what people are watching, listening, they have their own modernity. It's not that they're going back. It's not revanchism. They're making their own modernity. And, you know, it's not, you know, it's not like when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. You're not just, you know, turning on the record and the radio and listening to American stuff, or European stuff.
Mr. Peng, as far as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's not only about attraction, but also dogma. And you yourself wrote that the entire field of international relations seemed to be a projection of European historical and political experiences. And it makes it far more difficult for other nations to, you know, put forth their own developmental models as equally valid, as equally legitimate, rather than being, you know, shorter than this high European standard. And I guess this is my last question to you today. What do you think it will take to change that, both in academic discussions and, more importantly, in geopolitical communication and in real politics?
You know, I've dabbled on the academic side of this, and there's really... The argument is not won by talking about it. It's not being won by people making the argument. It's important to put the argument out there, but it's really history that is making this change. Europe has projected its own experience, its own interesting and difficult, but also very exploitative, right, in its relationship with the rest of us, experience, and created a kind of worldview, in fact, social sciences out of this. And people are just departing from that. As we, you know, as we arrive at a more multipolar world, we are also intellectually going to be more multipolar. Mm-hmm. Our models of international relations are going to change. They're not going to be built on European experience and then universalizing it to the rest of us and saying, oh no, you're just going to behave, you're not going to behave just like that. These have really harmful consequences. Mm-hmm. So it's a very interesting time to be thinking and talking about these things.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, we have come to an end of this fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Fascinating speaking with you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.